This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible with support from Afternoon Cyber Tea. Staying a step ahead of cyber threats can be the difference between thriving and being thwarted. Afternoon Cyber Tea with Ann Johnson has insights for cybersecurity decision makers striving to succeed amid rapid change. Each week, Ann Johnson, Corporate Vice President for Cybersecurity Solutions at Microsoft, talks with key security experts to explore perspectives on implementing new tech, next generation security risks, and the current and future state of cybersecurity industry. Afternoon Cyber Tea is available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. Now on with the show.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, May 21st, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Hello and welcome to this week's episode. If you're watching the video right now, you may notice that our streak of having our three normal crew is over, but we have a special guest this week. Jeremy's still here, which is good. Hi, Jeremy. You know what's embarrassing, Jeremy? Glad I wore a sweater, but we're wearing the same t-shirt.
Oh man. Nerds.
Wow. It's embarrassing for so many reasons, but I'm so glad I'm wearing a sweater. You're wearing a Star Lords t-shirt. That's, of course, the arcade cabinet that you and the team and Sean built and the guys at Other Ocean. It's a great t-shirt. Sean sells it on Etsy, but it's one of my go-tos. You also heard him chime in. Kishore's not here this week, but we have a special guest, Devendra Hardwar from Engadget and Slash Filmcast. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you doing? Happy to be here trying to, like, stay sane. I have so many reviews to go through, but yeah.
Oh, my God.
I can always make time for you.
I obviously most people know you from Engadget. You cover, you write articles, you reviews, and I want to use at least when we get to the tech section, a chance to talk about the things that you've been testing, covering,
for sure.
And also how you've been working from home, making content and making videos and your workflow, because I'm sure people are fascinated by that, and it's kind of thing that we're all dealing with as we're trying to cover the stuff we normally cover without being able to go to events, watching virtual press conferences, briefings, and reviewing gear. But how are you doing primarily as a father?
Yeah. And I also know you're kind of in the same boat as me, Norm. But yeah, I have a 19-month-old now. Yeah, she's 19 months old. She is crazy and running around. Sophia started walking a little late, so she's now like catching up for all of that by just like running around the house. But yeah, my wife is right now just dealing with her and wrangling her, and we kind of trade off when we can. That's the hard part of all of this, is that, you know, I feel like if it was just me and my wife at home watching movies, reading books, like that's totally fine. But once you have a kid in the picture, it's like, oh man, I'm also worried about her socialization and she can't be near other kids. And it's a lot of stuff. We're just trying to stay safe. I hope you guys are too.
Yeah, absolutely. Your daughter's 19 months old. My son's 18 months old. So We're right at the same age. And I think there's pros and cons to it. The silver lining is, you know, what a time to be able to spend extra time that normally, you know, you would be going somewhere or going out and traveling with your kid in this crucial developmental period, which is really awesome, you know, being at home for that. But also they run the schedule, right?
Yeah.
We were both in like the same press briefing a little earlier, and I'm literally getting texts from my wife, like, there's a poo right now. And I can't help. And I feel super guilty about that. And normally if I'm at the office, I'm like, oh, I can't be there.
Oh, wow.
But here I could have been there and I'm not. And that sucks. Jeremy, your kids can take care of themselves, right?
I have a 124-month-old.
Okay.
And a 156-month-old. I did the math while you guys were discussing it. And they frankly love it. You know, they're just on Zoom all day long, either in class or with friends. And they're just absorbing the screen time like, you know, no other time in their lives. So it's so far so good on that front. So you know, I feel for you guys with the kids at the young age. It is a sensitive time for socialization, and you're still figuring everything out and hoping to do everything right. But it's going to be fine. I'm sure you guys are going to, your kids are going to be just fine.
Yeah. We're just trying to stay safe. I am planning an escape from New York, hopefully sometime soon, just because New York is crazy right now. I'm in Brooklyn and, you know, I'm near Prospect Park and there's a lot of cool stuff here normally. And in the before times, it was great because there's a ton of playgrounds, a ton of kids, a ton of space to run around. And now that's all off limits. So, you know, we're just trying to survive. And yeah, maybe we'll head down south a bit.
Have we as a internet culture properly labeled the before times as the before times now? Like what is that? Are we still too much in the midst of it?
I like the before times. Having read enough post-apocalyptic fiction. Yeah, the before times. I like the way Cloud Atlas begins, just the baller way. Cloud Atlas starts off with after the fall. That's right. It. That's all the context you have for where society is at that point. And like, okay, I get it now.
I heard BQ and AQ yesterday for the first time.
Oh, interesting.
An option.
I mean, AQ is still, you know, months and months away potentially, right? And
right.
Like I said, there could be like very delineated eras that we don't know yet and to come, right? And the grouping of all this and in the cultural lexicon.
Yeah.
But definitely the before time, before the fall, before the lockdown, whatever we want to call it, that is something like clear in our memory and something that, you know, your kids being 100 and something months old can remember, but our kids can't. And so we are of that age where, you know, we can describe before the internet, before smartphones, before lockdown.
What a transitional generation. Yeah.
What a time it is to be alive, for sure. But we only have you for a limited time. Thank you for generously giving your time to join us on the podcast. So we're going to get right to it. Last week, we did something special on the podcast in which we reversed the order of our usual topics. We typically cover pop culture first and then up down to VR last, but we got a lot of great responses from folks out there who like covering VR first. So we're going to stick with this backwards order and maybe the new normal for this show. But of course, we always have to do the top story because the top story sticks to the top. So here we go with the music cue.
Top story this week.
Coincidentally, top story is also going to be virtual reality related. And this is going to be, this is definitely big news for people covering VR who play VR on a regular basis. You know, it's crazy that Half-Life Alyx came out during the quarantine, at least during the quarantine in where we're living, different parts of the country. But it was right there in the middle of March 16th. I remember it was one of those first things. You reviewed it for Engadget. I reviewed it for Tested. And it was one of the first pieces of like big content that we had to produce completely from home. Like I remember chatting with my friend Dan Stapleton over at IGN, and he reviewed it for IGN, and he had to do his video VO sitting in his closet, essentially, when he would have to go into a studio. Like that's one of those things that we're still figuring out how to produce. So it feels like a lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm. But Half-Life Alyx is like a weird example of something where a lot of people got invites to go test it out in Seattle. Like we had all this plans, like there was a press day, there was a preview day, and then a lot of people made plans. We were going to send somebody from London to Seattle to play the game. Wow. And then everything fell apart so quickly. And yeah, so I guess I lucked out then because I could review it at home, but what a weird situation that like all happened within the span of a few weeks.
It's also a game where when you play it, it's not unlike like a post-apocalyptic kind of experience anyway.
It's and the so, after times. There's a quarantine zone and everything. Yeah,
exactly. So it's all, it was very, very meta and a little too close to home in some respects. But I think it lent itself to that, you know, visceral feeling.
Yeah, what a timing for the release, because, you know, the headsets were selling out everywhere. People were buying VR headsets. And we'll talk about all of that stuff in the VR minute. But since then, now 2 months later, even though like the weird thing is that we had all this months of built up anticipation for Alyx, and it feels like waiting a lifetime for that game to come out. And now the game has been out and it feels like a lifetime ago that since the game, since we played through the game and and reviewed it.
Time has also lost all meaning at this point.
What are days? Exactly. Yeah. What is this flat circle that is life? Valve has pretty much on schedule put out the workshop tools now for Alex, which is our top story. So modders, this is huge because not only can modders create maps, create campaigns, but this is the equivalent of kind of that level editor that came out with all the previous, with Team Fortress, with the original Half-Life, that spawned things like Counter-Strike and spawned things like Day of Defeat. And this could be a big milestone for user-generated content in VR. The workshop tools are just in Steam. If you have Alex, it's super easy to download. They're all ready. This listing, you subscribe to it just as you would any other kind of custom map and custom campaign that you get for a game that's on Steam. They're relatively small. Valve themselves put out a demo map, like a small combine encounter, but people have been already creating, and even before the workshop tools, people have been hacking their way into creating kind of endless wave campaigns, horde mode, essentially. There's no multiplayer yet, but some of the notable standouts so far, people already incorporating melee. There's a lightsaber map where you have essentially a one-blade or two-bladed lightsaber. And since you have the gravity gloves in Alex, you have force power, essentially. And so it's been really fun to jump in there and force grab your lightsaber. You know, the collisions for the lightsaber and the head crabs and the zombies aren't exactly as you expect, but a lot of people are already anticipating this being kind of the blade and sorcery equivalent for Half-Life Alex, which a lot of people in VR love.
Mm-hmm. Someone else has ported that one of the levels from Portal 2. You can't actually play it, sadly, but, you know, it's only been a week. I'm sure give it some time and we'll be able to do all kinds of things thanks to the modders.
I think Portal, bringing Portal to VR, by the way, is just such a recipe for disaster.
Bring it. Like, bring it.
Oh, man. Because I remember I talked to some of the Valve developers and they had gone through, you know, several properties that they could have brought to VR. Portal was one of them. And then it's also like, the idea of jumping through those portals, creating some of those loops where you're just going up and down super quickly, like, oh man, that's a good way to drive somebody insane. That's like a Black Mirror torture device, right?
Not for everybody.
Yeah.
I think they would have to constrain it, just like in some VR games where, like Lone Echo, you have zero gravity and it works. Zero gravity works really well in VR if you lock in and you don't allow, by default, the rotational turns that you can do. Really, it's all lateral movements. You would have to do portals, you know, when we're talking about these kind of holes in space, in a way that they would be oriented at least the same way as a default option. So if you're going through a space, maybe there's dropping in somewhere, but you're not, at least not rotating. You're not off-axis portaling, which was a key part of the Portal games, but you know, they'd have to redesign that.
So much. And even Melee, like, I really wonder, there have been some good Melee games. I can understand why Valve was like, this is why we don't have the wrench, you know, in there. It makes sense because as soon as you start swinging things around, like, you will destroy things in your office. You will hit your monitor. You'll hit your wall. Like, Melee and VR does not play well together, honestly.
Well, it's interesting, there's though, the safety hazard. Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was just going to say it does lend itself to near field interactions, which VR excels at. Yeah, that's where you get a sense of things being inside your personal space bubble. So, you know, I like that aspect of Melee, but
most definitely.
You know, I feel like, but you're absolutely right. Like, people have destroyed, there are entire photo albums of people who, you know, of things that have been broken inside people's homes.
It's a physics problem also. If you look at the contrast between the decisions made for Half-Life Alyx and what was done for Boneworks, in which they really leaned into embodiment and physics, you just, because you don't have the resistant feedback, the haptic feedback, you basically have to disassociate the virtual, whatever you're holding, you know, when you're slamming a crowbar, a wrench against a resistant object, whether it's a table surface or an enemy, you know, because you don't feel that, you either have to be lightsabers and slice through cleanly, or your virtual hand gets pushed back and that then causes discomfort. Now, plenty of people are okay with that in a game like Blade and Sorcery, a game like a melee game like Gorn. People are totally cool with physics objects and simulated weight, right, as another thing. But Alex clearly was a game that was to bridge, you know, It was a high, you know, AAA game, high quality of the bridge, traditional gaming in the VR gaming. And I can see why they did not do that. But the other thing is that, you know, we don't know how much money Half-Life or Valve spent on Alyx, and their estimate says it's the tens of millions of dollars. And it's a fundamentally different approach from a big company to invest in their own development team to make a AAA game that's like their shiny example of what a single player VR game could be versus what Facebook Oculus is doing, which is seed money into the development community. Valve seeds support and hardware into the development community. But they're fundamentally different approaches. Like Oculus will pay for exclusives and pay for developers to make content and experiment in those ways. And that will yield things like Lone Echo, like, you know, like Beat Saber now that they've acquired. But for Valve, it's the modding tools. Like they made this AAA game, built in these systems, and now it's going to be up to the people who, you know, want to inspire to work at a place like Valve to create their maps. And for you know, both of those are, I think, essential for growing the entire spectrum of VR content.
I mean, it also builds on all the hardware work they've been doing and the support for Steam VR and everything. I have a lot of criticisms for Valve as a game developer, but I think as a weird entity that is just building all these tools and all these cool things that you know, affect the gaming landscape forever, I still respect the hell out of them. So yeah, I'm hoping a lot comes out of Half-Life Alyx. I loved it. That was one of my favorite gaming experiences of the last decade. Like that's the thing you could put somebody in and show them the power of VR. But again, we're still dealing with all the problems. Not enough headsets. They're too expensive. You need a powerful computer. I'm really hoping we're not hearing much about VR for the next gen consoles, but I'm really hoping like Half-Life Alyx is something you could easily boil down to like that level of hardware and make it playable in a living room.
Yeah,
so I'm hoping
and that would be
there.
A true test to their kind of their mission statement. Are they in it just to get people onto Steam, or are they really in it to grow the ecosystem and the user base as a whole? I think 4 years ago, when all the hopes for VR were skyrocketing and everyone was waiting for that hockey stick moment, which never came, people can feel more isolated. But now it's like in every VR company's interest to kind of work together, share knowledge, maybe loosen up on those that exclusivity just to get people into the system and to realize its potential. We've been talking a lot about VR, so let's just jump right to our VR minute.
The VR minute, virtual reality this week.
What also felt like a lifetime ago was the release of the Oculus Quest, when in fact, it's only been almost exactly 1 year since the Quest came out. Doesn't it feel like it's been out for at least 2 years now?
I mean, everything feels like it's like Game of Thrones. The finale was a year ago.
Oh my God.
That feels
right.
Like 10 years ago at this point. But yeah, it feels like the Quest has been here forever at this point.
I lose track. Like where does the Quest and the Rift overlap, and how long have I been into VR? I have no idea.
Yeah.
But with the Quest, kind of the consolidation of Oculus's like their vision for VR, you know, with touch controllers, inside out tracking, and all this stuff, it feels more like a cohesive product and direction versus this exploration of VR. And of course, they've improved it a lot over the past year, which is another reason that it feels like it's been a long time. You know, for at Kinect, they announced things like the Oculus Link feature, the Link cable's been out, and they celebrated the 1 year anniversary with a couple of announcements, which we'll run through now. So, first of all, the hand tracking feature that was launched as an experimental feature, and people could tap into it in the Quest to see your hands in the main UI, that is leaving beta. It is going to be a full-fledged part of the standard release Quest, and they said there have been some improvements with this. It's not out, and I don't think the updates are out yet, so I haven't noticed any of that. But not only is it out of beta, that also means the content is going to be coming out. So developers can start submitting, and so have been submitting, but start releasing games and experiences that support natively hand tracking, including the Elixir demo that we saw at Oculus Connect last year, as well as some adaptations to existing VR games like Waltz of the Wizard. And also, I think there's the Pets game.
Curious Tale of the Stolen Pets.
That will also have native hand tracking support. What are you guys' thoughts on hand support? Have you used this, Devendra, in the Quest?
I mean, a little bit, mainly from what I tested at Connect, and we talked about it back then. It's really cool, the fact that it works so well. But I haven't, in this test period, like I haven't found anything that really grabbed me with it. So I'm hoping some bigger releases kind of take advantage of that. Have you guys seen anything at this point?
Well, we played the Elixir demo. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for that to come out just because I do think it's a good demo of hand tracking. It's better than what people have seen so far anyway. And I did confirm with Oculus that will be a free title. So that's just going to be out on their store. Anybody will be able to get it. And it will be a hand tracking exclusive title. The other two titles that Norm mentioned are, of course, also touch compatible. So they've sort of mm-hmm. taken touch games and made them hand tracking games. And to be fair, like the Waltz of the Wizard actually looks really interesting. The way that they've incorporated locomotion by sort of flicking your finger out and casting a ray, that's kind of neat. But mm-hmm. where gamers are going to have a problem is with the latency, because there is going to be a lot more latency with hand tracking than with touch controllers. And I'll be curious, like, how far developers and gamers willing to take hand tracking. You know, like we saw last week, we talked about that augmented reality sort of proof of concept of Beat Saber, where somebody's playing with their fingers. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm not sure would actually work in real life.
Right. Yeah. You know. The hardware in the Quest is not powerful enough to really do all that real time tracking. But I'm interested in seeing how apps use it. I'm actually surprised. So I've been trying out the Quest again more recently just to see some new experiences.
We see you flexing mm-hmm. it right there in the background.
Oh, yeah. That's right there in the back. Yeah.
Baby Yoda's using it. Yeah.
Yeah. Baby Yoda loves the Oculus Quest. Come on. I was surprised there was no Google Earth on Quest, just because I've spent so much time with it on the desktop side. So I would love to see a version of that scaled down for the Quest hardware, because it would be so great in, you know, completely hands-free and everything. But imagine like hand tracking to manipulate the map, to glide around the world. Like that sort of thing would be fascinating and Absolutely. Doesn't take super fast latency. You're just sweeping your arm or something to travel the globe.
So what's interesting is we're talking about all these applications in terms of interaction for gamers and experiences as an alternative to the touch. There's also a fundamental comfort question. And Jeremy, you said, you know, gamers might not like the latency. I'm more curious about the layperson thinks about hand tracking, because if someone's new to VR and they bought Quest and that's their first VR headset and you have the touch controllers, as intuitive and natural feeling as the touch controllers are, because it's a natural grip, it still has a little bit of a learning curve. You know, on the Quest and on the Rift, there's a tutorial that you go through, the first steps, to give you a sense of what all the buttons do. And you don't need that with, theoretically, you wouldn't need that with hand tracking, because if you put on a headset with hand tracking, you would just see a representation of your hands, and that adds comfort because it's familiarity of your fingers moving, and you have natural laser pointer stuff. But what we're also learning is that in addition to that latency, you know, there are limitations with occlusion and just fundamental interaction, because you don't get haptics with hand tracking, right? You can't press a button and feel the tips of your finger hit something. And with the UIs in the user interface in virtual reality with floating menus, you know, things aren't naturally within arm's reach. They're not kind of at your desktop where your keyboard would be. They're floating in space. So you have to do some type of laser pointing, some ray casting, and that requires a tutorial. That requires onboarding. And the limitations aren't just for latency and for occlusion. Mm-hmm. It's also for gesture recognition, right? If we're seeing all this opportunity for interaction in games with, you know, not just grabbing things, but also, you know, like poses of like flying in Google Earth, right? Putting your hands out, right? Right now, the Quest has limitation in that it can only have confidence on a limited number of gestures. You know, their click gesture. People who use like the HoloLens have known, like, you can only basically have discrete clipping, a tapping of your index or your middle finger and your thumb as a way to tell the system you are clicking. That's the analog for a click. I think the Quest can recognize your hand orientation. So if you flip your palm up and you click your fingers together, then that's like the equivalent of a home button. But there are so many different poses that they'll have to figure out a way to standardize. And that's going to take, you know, iteration of, you know, maybe deep learning of the poses and what people at different hand sizes and different hand poses. And it's not going to be as easy as someone, a developer, with a touch controller saying, okay, a button is a button. And that will always be a button.
Yeah, the Waltz of the Wizard guys seem to have figured out snapping. I don't know if you watched their touch launch or hand tracking launch trailer, but there's a lot of that where they're making spells happen with a snap. And I wonder if they're incorporating the microphone,
interesting. To see if
there's like a gesture along with the sound, and they combine the two. You might use that, because I don't imagine that was something that Oculus did. I think that seemed like something that the developers figured out, since that's the only demo that seems to be using that. But back to your original point about hand tracking being sort of user friendly for people who maybe aren't gamers, I think that's the biggest selling point of it. Absolutely. And they know that. Like, one of the demos that we saw was a maintenance worker, walking around a house, like finding leaks and things and pointing at them and basically demonstrating that anybody can now put on this headset. You don't even need the controllers, and they can interact with the world. And while there will be some kind of tutorial learning process for that, I think people are happy to learn that. It's when people who aren't gamers are forced to use touch controllers and memorize all these different buttons without being able to often see them because they're wearing a VR headset. That's where the point of frustration comes in.
Well, that's why you have tooltips, right? That's why so many interactions ghost the version of the controller and literally point out where the buttons are. But if you're talking about an experience like Elixir that's purely hand tracking, and there are a lot of demos in side quests where you can sideload these hand tracking experiments that you don't need and you can't use your touch controllers. If you are a native touch controller user, if that's your default way and your quickest way to get around the UI, that requires then this, taking off the controllers, putting the controllers back on, and that adds friction to the experience, right? Mm-hmm. And Elixir will be the first one where I imagine a lot of people will be holding controllers, launch a game, take off controllers, show hands, interact with the game, then put the controllers back on. And these are all considerations that the user experience team at Oculus have to consider. There's always been the question of if they're confident enough in the hand tracking, and hand tracking is enabled by the Qualcomm processor, the A35, having enough headroom to do the computer vision with the 30 FPS cameras on the Quest, will they, in a next version of the Quest or in a future SKU, release a version without any physical controllers and make that completely optional if there's enough of a library of content that's, hand tracking only? Is that going to be the new Oculus Go? And I on paper, it sounds like a no-brainer, but I'm leaning further and further away from that because of things like latency, because of things like comfort and tutorial. I'm not convinced with the tech right now that's going to be a viable option.
It's just the segmentation that I feared. VR is already so small. To fragment that would be a mistake, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that is innately beneficial about having these hand track controllers and also hand tracking is communication, right? Communication tools, things like big screen. And Oculus has partnered, or they're going to start releasing two tools, Immersed and Spatial. These are existing applications. DaVinci, you did an interview with the Spatial team, right? This is an existing kind of like Zoom for VR. Can you talk about your experience with that? And it wasn't on the Quest, but it was on a traditional VR, tethered VR headset?
Well, it was on the Quest, actually. So the whole thing was Spatial, right? So we covered them 2 years ago when they initially launched for enterprise customers. And we called it FaceTime for VR because the idea was that you would put on maybe a HoloLens because it supports that. It supports Magic Leap's headset and also like some other things. Nreal, they said they've tested on, which is the cool goggle thing. So they've been mainly focused on AR up until now for businesses. And last week they announced that it's coming to the Oculus Quest. It's coming to web browsers. It's coming to iOS and Android. So they're kind of opening up this whole virtual meeting thing. The idea is that people on the web or iOS or Android will have like a window into the virtual meeting room. And they're actually rendering the meeting in the cloud, streaming it to your device. So it's sort of, it is game streaming. It's the way every game streaming service works. But you don't have much interactivity, but you can video chat with people in the room without a headset. You could drop in 3D objects and the camera kind of pans around. But then I put on the Oculus Quest and I jumped in there and it felt like a revelation because I have not had like a physical meeting, with anybody for a while, like for the past 2 months. So it was the closest thing I've had to a traditional business meeting since I've been in quarantine. And I think that's the real value. I was standing next to the CEO's avatar and the chief product officer's avatar. We were bringing in objects into the room, discussing ideas. They dropped us into a 3D map of like a a cell phone store, and we could walk around it and see, like, oh, you would put products here, you'd put signage here, and then they could shrink it down so we're looking at it from above. It really shows the flexibility of VR and what you can do with it. And to me, it seems like a really functional way to work together with other people too, because the people without headsets, they can just peep into the meeting. They can come in through their webcams. Everybody else has like a really cool way to interact and actually talk about objects. If they're designing something in 3D, they can bring in a 3D file and have a full view of that. So I found that really compelling. I think they're going to have a lot of interest moving forward. And also they're free. They're offering their service for free now, just like Zoom is. So they're really trying to attract more people who want to collaborate in virtual ways.
Their avatars look kind of interesting or unique anyway. It looks like they do some sort of body scan for every person. Do you know, is that done using a cell phone? Did they do that for you?
No, it just, I took a webcam photo and I uploaded it and it kind of mapped itself onto an avatar. It brought in my glasses even. The glasses look like they're mapped onto the model, so it's not like a separate thing. But the executives did do a full-scale 3D map of themselves. So their avatars look a little better. So like there is the option to kind of have different levels of quality there.
It's like traditional video game scan, like NBA 2K style. You take a picture of yourself and it maps onto some predetermined forms, or they've used deep learning and know, okay, glasses should map on to these type of glasses models. Got it.
Yeah. So that process was pretty easy. And then, jumping into the meetings is also as easy as Zoom. It's about clicking a link. If it's in a browser, I just clicked the link. When I launched Spatial on the Oculus Quest, I just hopped into an open meeting that I was invited to. It was pretty cool. I can imagine a lot of, especially like tech product briefings, stuff like Norm and I typically attend, like that would be a cool way to do it, because I find a lot of Zoom briefings where people are holding up a computer to me aren't as interesting. Like I can't really see a product. I can't really discuss it. But if I could, explore a 3D model of something, that would be a lot more useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the ease of access, decrease in friction where you just click a link. Yeah. That's one of the reasons that Zoom has really exploded in this virtual communication space. And also the asymmetrical use of it, right? That you don't need a VR headset that people, Facebook had their own tool that they kind of shuttered called Facebook Spaces that was asymmetrical. I think it's, Zuckerberg demoed it at a Connect a couple of years ago, where you could be in a Rift and be in, doing a virtual meeting, and then someone using just the Facebook app or Messenger could have a window and peer into the world. And that's what's going to be necessary to make any type of VR meeting work right now, because not everyone's going to have a headset, and you want people to have, with just desktops and webcams like this, to still be able to interact.
It's a shame, they kind of gave up on Spaces, because there's a lot of room to make that work. Like, we're still waiting for a great platform to do this. I don't know, maybe they could revive it down the line. Facebook is, focusing more on stuff like the portal cameras, which I think launched poorly, but now that we're stuck at home and doing a lot of video chats with people, they are good products for that respect. So I don't know, maybe they made the right bet for this point.
They have Horizon coming out, on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And I imagine they're putting a lot of resources into that. I hope that that is the evolution of it. When it comes to things like Spatial, I mentioned the avatars because I think that's an important part. It's still obviously early days, and Uncanny Valley doesn't even begin to, describe the problems that exist. But once we have live facial scanning, like some sort of camera-based system where we're actually representing a live feed, almost like a real combination of video chat and VR, I think that's going to be a tipping point for...
It's going to be huge. Do you guys remember at Oculus Connect, there was that trippy demo, I think during the Carmack speech, where they showed off somebody wearing an Oculus headset and the avatar was a direct representation of their face moving and expressing as they talked. I think
with eye tracking, right?
With eye tracking, yeah. And that, I can't get that out of my mind just because it looked so real and so trippy. So hopefully we'll see more stuff like that down the line.
Yeah, totally. We'll also be remiss not to mention the company Spaces. That's a location-based experience. They had set up like The Void and had a partnership with movie theaters, and that team's been working remotely, but they've been putting out their own Unity-based VR meeting software for things like Zoom. So you basically are in VR, but then you cast out to to Zoom as a virtual camera. So it's for, it's again, asymmetrical experience, but allowing someone in VR to do things like hold virtual objects, use a whiteboard, and gives you a little bit more of that feeling of being there. Spatial is cloud-based, which I thought is worth mentioning because that kind of helps with the rendering and the latency, but also could increase some privacy concerns. And that's something we all should be aware of, all this stuff. If all your data and your movements are being sent and then redistributed, you know, you don't have control over that necessarily. Two more updates on the Oculus side for the Quest. Well, version 17 of the software is being pushed out to users right now. They have an updated Guardian. So this is, again, for comfort. And not only can you change the boundary color, but it also does dynamic detection of objects. This is super cool. Kind of what everyone's been hoping for with, like, the cat walking into your play space.
Is that confirmed? Because I don't know if it's dynamic.
It is not dynamic.
Okay.
It's not for the cat. It is still for the scan of, like, tables and chairs. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the visualization is a type of, like, point cloud with these vectors that go to the ground, these rays that go to the ground. So you see, if you get close to your table, it'll pop in as a volumetric guardian as opposed to just the border, the circular border, whatever shape you draw around your room. Incrementally, we're getting to a point where it becomes more and more mixed reality. You know, right now you can do the pass through, and one of the fun things that no one expected they did was, of course, double tapping the side of your headset to enable the pass through camera, just using the accelerometer and the headset. And again, these are all things that will make new VR users more comfortable and safe as they use VR. An undocumented feature that someone on Reddit found last week, and this is kind of a big deal for people who want to play desktop VR games like Half-Life Alyx on the Quest, is that you can now use the charging cable that comes with the Quest, USB 2 cable, and use that to do Link remote gameplay. So streaming gameplay from your laptop or your desktop rendered locally, and then rendered on your computer, and then stream to your headset. You don't need to buy the $80 cable for that. And that's you got to opt into the public test channel in the Oculus software for that to work. But I've tested it and it works great, and it saves you $80.
You don't notice any degradation to the video quality at all?
It's the exact same experience. I've done a bunch of games, Half-Life Alyx, some new ones. Yeah, because the current Link cable is, even though it's USB-C, it's fiber optic, which gives you the extra length for sure, right? 5 meters. It's really compressing still at 150 megabits. And the cap, they did a whole talk at Connect where they talked about the ways to optimize for remote rendering, which is a big thing they're working on, because we anticipate wireless to be something they want to do in the future. But it's not just the image quality, but also the latency, right? And they're doing like a mid-frame rendering. You're decoding on the headset as the next frame is being sent. And so there's a cap on the decode bandwidth on the Qualcomm chip. And I don't think they've tapped that yet. John Carmack, when he was still at Oculus, talked about wanting to saturate the USB 3.1 bandwidth. But 150 megabits per second is what it currently uses, and USB 2 has plenty enough for that. Last bits of updates on the Oculus side. Jeremy, you've pointed this out, but they officially released the mixed reality capture software.
Yeah, and they didn't make a huge deal out of it either. You know, maybe because you do need a green screen. Like, so this isn't for everybody. This isn't like fake backgrounds in Zoom or anything like that. But it's an interesting tool that supports a limited number of games. I forget the games off the top of my head, but there's like 10 games it supports, including Beat Saber. If you have a green screen, you go through a calibration process where you basically install an app on your Quest, or you run it on your Rift, and then you run an app on your PC, and then it shows you these like outlines of touch controllers, and you have to line them up. They're sort of augmented on the screen, and you put your touch controller over top of it, press the button. You do that 10 times, and that's how it learns. I assume it triangulates where the camera is, and it sort of understands the 3D volume. And then you shoot your video, and you can basically map your human self into a VR render of the game, capture of the game. Super cool that they just released that for free. It's a pretty nice looking tool. And the fact that it actually is also an app that runs in real time on the Quest means that, you know, it's not something that just anybody could do on their own. This is something that needed Oculus's approvals.
So this is a way that you could, I mean, it's to create like those kind of gameplay trailers, or for people who do Twitch streaming, you know, mixed reality, seeing not just an avatar of yourself on a third person camera, which is some games support having a virtual camera, but your actual video of yourself with the green screen. And it does a lot of what Live, which is a company that has worked with Oculus to create commercials, has done. And it's, of course, requires compatibility in those apps. So Beat Saber, Super Hot, and stuff that's, you know, basically Oculus Direct supported. The calibration is interesting because it also means that you don't need a tracker on the camera. Previously, when people were using Vive setups and Steam VR based setups to create mixed reality, you'd essentially mount on top of your hot shoe of your camera a Vive tracker and then do a calibration based on that. So you'd say like the Vive tracker is about 4 inches above where the camera sensor is. And then you kind of map also what the virtual lens looks like. And because you want to have that same field of view. Live, you do a similar calibration where you're wearing the headset and you again like map out 4 different spots to calibrate your relationship with the video camera. Here it looks like they have high confidence with those 10 spots that you click. It's a very niche use case, but I think it's going to be useful for developers to create promotional videos for the content. That's probably be the number one use for this. And then also content creators who want to show themselves playing Super Hot, Beat Saber, and have that third person camera.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the actual product page, they have a screenshot of Racket NX, but they don't have that game listed. So maybe
coming soon.
Maybe coming soon.
Gotcha. Do you think, I know it's a little niche, but do you think it's something general people would want to use down the line to share this sort of gameplay with their friends or something, and not just if they're a streamer?
Totally. They'd have to figure out a way to do it without green screen, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And Live does that right now. If you use the Microsoft, what's it called? The Kinect, the new Kinect camera, which has depth sensing, and they use that depth sensing info. The crop around you, the masking, isn't as perfect as if you had keying with the green screen, but it's good enough for VR. And Live also has experimental features like moving virtual camera. Mm-hmm. And that's real trippy because the physical camera isn't actually moving. It's the virtual camera that's moving, as well as your in-headset view. And so you have to physically turn to make it look like the camera is moving around you, but in reality, you're just turning. Yeah. Also out on the Quest Store, we've been waiting for this for a long time, but Tetris Effect is out. It's a little bit pricey, full price game, $30. But you know, when this came out on PSVR and on the Epic Game Store, it was one of those things that we all said, this would be great on the Quest, great on a mobile headset. And
at the time, I think I said it'd be great on Go. I'm not sure I knew about the Quest at the time. I love this game. Like $30, easy. Like I'm in. I think this is one of those games that for some people, maybe, you know, more casual players, this is going to be their Beat Saber. Like this is going to be their jam. I think this is a great game.
The one feature I would want from this game is a true lean back mode. Mm-hmm. Right now it's like the thing holding me back from playing this all the time on the couch is the ergonomics of the Quest. It's a little front heavy, you know, and I don't see the outside world, but I want to lean back on my bed and have the game reorient so it's on the ceiling rather than in front of me.
You want a lean down experience or a lay down experience.
Full lean back mode. Full recline.
Lean back mode. Yeah.
Yes. Full recline on Tetris. Also, a mixed reality version would be cool.
Because I think I'm waiting for that, for the mixed reality idea, just because it's I've tried it. It's fine. I like Tetris just fine. But this also, it is just Tetris in VR. You know, it's really how much you are into that. I would love some more like dynamic camera movements. I would love like something that really gives me the presence of what I'm doing. But you know, otherwise it's a very fun test for it in VR. I just want more, I think.
It's isolating, right? And gonna be good for some people who want that flow state, who want good headphones and just zone out to Tetris. Mm-hmm. But if you want kind of the passive Tetris while watching something in the real world, we're gonna have to wait for some type of mixed reality.
For sure. It could be a good one for the Chromecast casting that the Quest has built in, and doing that to a TV and people could actually watch you do that. That's something I want to experiment more with. Yeah.
I'm with you, Devendra, on it's just Tetris and VR, but I think that undersells it. But I struggle with this because I've always thought a barometer for a VR game should be, at least one of the things you measure, is does it require VR to be the game that it is, or could you play it on a phone or any other console? And obviously you can play Tetris on anything, so this is not that, so it doesn't qualify for that. But at the same time, it really, the VR aspect of it, where you have these visuals happening all around you, and it's also, I think, a large part the synchronization between the music and the visuals that puts you in a zone. Like, the whole marketing behind this game is, there's a book, right, called Tetris Effect, which is all about being in the zone and like attaining this like surreal like Zen state, and that's what the game tries to do. And I don't know if I get in the zone or not, but I play it on easy.
Right.
But
I think I'm somebody who's been like, I'm really into Thumper, and Thumper has been great for years. And that's the sort of thing where you're like, whoa, what is happening to me in VR? Because you are moving at a 1,000 miles an hour, and the world just feels like it's all around you. What is the Dreamcast game, the Dreamcast music game, I believe, isn't it?
Rez
coming back. I think Rez in VR is astounding. So
it's the same group, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because Thumper and Tetris Effect are both VR games that have PS4 flat screen versions. They're literally just flat screen games, and then they've ported to VR to encompass your whole field of view as if you're playing on a giant IMAX screen or surround screen with spatial audio. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it goes to show that VR games, even if they're just ports of traditional games, doesn't all need to be like a super hypercube where you need to move your head around to look around the objects. The isolating factor is a plus here for a lot of people.
It's also worth pointing out that there is no motion controls to the hands either. Like, this is a game that really is completely visual and is, in all honesty, probably played best on a gamepad with a D-pad. And you can actually sync up a Bluetooth gamepad to Tetris Effect and play it that way. But you do have to launch it with the touch controller first. But Oculus seems, at least in the early days of Quest, to have been very careful about the games that they chose to release so that they would all incorporate touch controllers. And now they appear to be easing back a little bit on that. I'm hoping that leads to some interesting, not gamepad games, but maybe like driving games that don't necessarily have touch controls, but would be great in VR.
Oh God, driving games without physical driving controllers is something that I don't think any developers properly tackled yet. And again, goes back to the haptics of resistance of what it means to feel a steering wheel. Same with flight simulator games without flight sticks. Those are so much better with the track, not really track flight sticks, but gives you an extra point of kind of tracking. Mm-hmm. Moving away from the Oculus Store, there are some rumors on the AR side. First of all, Apple, which we kind of fully expect at some point to be releasing AR glasses in some form factor or another. They very publicly talked about it being a new frontier for them. They've confirmed they've bought the company Next VR. Now, if they're making AR headsets, why would they buy this company called Next VR? It's 100% about content. I don't know if you guys have tried Next VR software before, but it's video, essentially. They're a company that had expertise in making immersive 3D video for live events, for primarily sporting events. So they had partnerships with the NBA where you could, as opposed to watching on ESPN or TNT, you put on a headset and have commentators hear the full game, watch it live streamed also with these stereo cameras they had set up around the court. Now, how that content would port over to AR would essentially be its floating stereo. You'd be little windows into the space, which gives you maybe some indication of the direction Apple might want to go in, as you know, in creating a content catalog for AR whenever they're ready to release AR glasses.
I could see that being useful too. Like, as much as I love VR video and that experience of being in a 360 degree video, if you're just staring at a very large screen that's being mapped over your face and you still get stereoscopic 3D, I think that could be really impressive, because then you're watching like a hovering 100-inch TV or something. I think that would get a lot of people into it. And we're still, the ultimate way to get people into AR and VR is this perfect goggles, the perfect goggles that can do kind of everything. So if anybody can do it, I feel like Apple would figure that out, but yeah, I'm not sure how they'd manage it. And after Magic Leap fell apart too, it's all kind of, it's hard to predict where things are going to go at this point.
It's interesting because VR video has, you know, even if you're talking about 180 degree, not 360 mm-hmm. degree, the optimized VR video right now is stereo 180. You get the most pixels per field of view. It's still encompassing. It's still fully encompassing. If you're talking about implementing that video in an AR space, it wouldn't necessarily be fully encompassing. You'd want to see mm-hmm. the real world. So it would be windowed. And I don't know comfort wise, whether windowed stereo video has the same effect as, you know, if it's high, you know, taped to your wall or hovering in front of your desk, if that has the same kind of immersion as the kind of VR video we see now being full field of view.
I don't, mm-hmm. I actually think that there are pros and cons to both. Like you can watch any 3D movie in big screen and see what, you know, stereo video looks like. When it's a huge screen that's mapped onto a wall. And the good side of that is you get like the ideal 3D experience because each eye gets its own independent screen, its own independent projection. Like if you go to a movie theater, you're wearing glasses that polarize and try to get one or the other, but there's always a little bit of ghosting and you have to wear sunglasses the whole movie. Yeah. You know, in VR, that's not the case. So that's a very good thing.
Get customized IPD with the rendering, right? Like mm-hmm. 3D movies, right. You are locked into whatever the filmmaker filmed the IPD at. There's definitely a sweet spot for the theater seat. That's why IMAX works best because the sweet spot is widened. And so all that leads to discomfort and not even talking about the convergence and accommodation conflicts that you get in that video. I think this feels less like the killer app content that Apple is trying to make with this and more about like just having a diverse amount of content whenever they launch and something that's relatable for people who may not be familiar with VR, AR, but to say things like, we have sports, you know, hey, sports fans, we got sports, we got live events as part of our package. But of course, they're going to have things like, you know, your virtual IKEA catalogs and all that stuff that people are experimenting in AR.
Quickly though, the downside of the 180 stuff though is that you lose translation. You lose the ability for the head to be able to move around. Then you're really talking about an Oculus Go kind of level experience.
Yeah.
The fear that a lot of people, you know, in the hobby have is that will become people's expectations of what VR is capable of. And that is not what VR is capable of. So I don't know if they're going to go, if they did go the flat, you know, screen in a 3D space that you can still move around in, I think that would actually be the smarter move.
Right. Then you're talking about a little virtual floating, like almost a little diorama box into a different world. You know, the Slow Mo guys did a VR video series, and for their stuff they shot with high-speed Phantom cameras, it had to, by necessity, be windowed. And so it was looking like, you know, like an IMAX 3D video, James Cameron style. And I could see that being pasted or floating in front of your table being as compelling as if it was fully immersive around you. But in terms of the hardware, there's no news or anything that we can kind of glean about what they're going with hardware, except for what they've been putting into the existing hardware. Although there are a lot of rumors and a lot of, you know, quote unquote leaks. Some analysts are expecting that Apple won't be putting out AR glasses until 2022, 2023.
Yeah, there's no reason to rush this, really. Like, just take your time, get it slow, because this, I think what we've seen since all the consumer VR headsets have come is that there are so many issues. Like, think compared to smartphones or something, like, that was, if you look at the scope of the problem, that was more a hardware thing. That was more teaching people how to use touchscreens. VR is space, comfort, so many different things, reteaching new control mechanisms. There's so much going into it. And then at the end of the day, even if you solve all that, you're still disconnected in a certain way. So it's a fundamental way of rethinking how we compute. So take your time.
Devendra, I'm curious what you think of this question, because I think when the iPhone came around, there were clear problems that needed to be solved.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm curious what problem AR is going to solve from Apple's perspective.
I mean, that's a good question. A lot of it, I'm not sure what the problem that AR is going to solve. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's sci-fi. It's stuff we've dreamed of for a while. For me, VR gives me a more immersive view of something. Like, it gives me a world I can jump into. AR almost seems like a toy. It doesn't seem as essential is the thing too. So yeah, I'm not sure what problems it's going to solve. Maybe
Jeremy,
when we're stuck at home. You know, that's something. Right. Yeah.
I think it's less about a problem that it's trying to solve and more about a problem or a want that people didn't realize they had, right? Like people didn't realize they wanted one-to-one direct touch interaction with media, with content before capacitive touchscreens on the iPhone 1. And now that's how we interact with all our digital content, mm-hmm. right? I think what AR is going to bring is a persistence because it's glasses, right? It's persistence of content. And where right now people are addicted to media feeds, mm-hmm. Facebook, Twitter, messages, you can think of that as a media feed, but you still have to bring up your phone. What people don't realize that they want and what Apple's hoping that people want and will pay money for is a persistence of that type of connectivity, where if you're wearing the glasses, you're going to get an unending feed. You don't have to launch an app to get see your Twitter feed. Your Twitter feed or whatever Apple's feed will be there all the time. And we don't know what that world looks like. Because right
that
now
sounds
we're so
like
used
a
to
nightmare, almost. Yeah, like we'll never be free of it.
But I mean,
yeah.
You tell someone 15 years ago that people looking down at their phones all day is a nightmare, and people mm-hmm. are totally—they're happy to do that today, right? And so it's a difference between what you know philosophically and on paper feels like it's the right thing to do, and what people just from our primal instincts want to do.
Right, right. And you look at how AR is being adapted now in the commercial space. Like to me, that's what's compelling. Like HoloLens and HoloLens 2 are doing great among engineering and people who need to be able to see models, maybe work on things, repair things remotely. And that's like a need. Those are filling a need. For consumers, it's a lot tougher. And I do feel like a lot of this is just a stopgap until we get to like, you know, easy holographics where you don't have to wear anything at all. Like that's what I want. That's what I think we all want is just like a screen that will just pop up and can be anywhere, can be located anywhere. Have you guys seen the show Amazon's Upload?
Not yet.
Fantastic. It's a show from Greg Daniels about a world where you can digitize yourself and go into the afterlife. But they also have simple computing concepts, just like their phones are holographic screens where if you create an L with your hand, it just kind of pops up. It's like you always have it. You don't always have to be looking at it. But if you pop up your hands, you'll get like a screen. You can like interact with it and see data that way. And yeah, it's not like the most insightful idea. But I do think we're going to find new ways to do a lot of this stuff. And maybe some people will want the AR glasses. I think a lot more people will want that true holographics eventually. You know, having a home that will just repaint itself as you need to. Maybe like that scene in Her that we keep pointing to, like the video game scene. That sort of stuff, projection holographics, would solve a lot more needs. Well, that'll get you like a giant screen at home that you can watch rather than mounting a TV or something. I think that would solve a lot.
I'm always cognizant of portrayals of these technologies in television where the effects team and the storytellers have to create mm-hmm. a very obvious like signal of like, this is a holographic screen. And so that L display we've seen is like very clearly it reads, this is the future. You know, this is a screen. It makes sense. We can do like mapping, and it's a technology that theoretically you could do a version of today, but from an actual like realistic use case, I don't think people want to hold up their hands like this whole time.
No.
They want to be able to pin a screen just in their virtual space and just have it be there the whole time without having to move their hands up. But that wouldn't work for, you know, like a TV representation of that technology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But their smartphones in that show are kind of cool. They're sort of like handcuff-like, like they're wrist computers, basically. Mm. And smartwatches haven't really gone anywhere, but I could kind of see us getting to a persistent kind of computing where maybe we do move away from the smartphones as these slabs and maybe something more that we can wear, computing that we can spread across our view and our lives. I think that's kind of where we're headed. Right now, I do feel kind of trapped within my phone. The phone has brought down the idea of the computer as a box into this thing I can interact with more easily. But now I want to spread it out and more people want to reject it too. Like more people want to get away from this because I think evolutionarily, we're not built to be bombarded by information 24/7.
Apple's even embraced that with the whole screen time feature, which, you know, is great for parents and the kids. But I think a lot of adults are using it, too, just to get themselves, you know, decoupled.
Yeah. Yep.
In terms of timing for Apple's AR glasses, a lot of it also is, you know, when they can do economies of scale for manufacturing. They've been like, it's their MO to slowly introduce technologies in the existing product lines, mm-hmm. you know, starting with all the way back with solid state memory and the iPod Nano, to then put solid state memory in the iPhone versus a spinning disk drive. And because they can then build up the economy scale for manufacturing, not to make products cheap, but to increase their product or their profit margin, because that's how they make money, yeah. right? They sell premium products that they can make at these mass quantities, but also the risk of failure is bigger on them than for any company.
Sure,
because if they're going to launch a whole new product category, they need to essentially dominate not just that industry, but also have relative success with their other products. And so you make these analogies with the Apple Watch, right? There's the debate of, is Apple Watch a success? And if you compare it to, sure, Rolex and other premium watches, it's kind of eclipsed all existing watch industry manufacturers.
It's basically the last smartwatch standing, you know, that counts for something, even though it's not as big a market as we expected.
But that's the thing. Is it a biggest market? Not just as we expected, but internally, as they hope, is it an iPhone sized business, right? And I think the only iPhone sized business they have right now, it's not MacBooks, it's not iPad, it's services, it's subscriptions. And we'll see what, and that, so any product they release in the future, I can see being tied to whatever their services business is. I'll go with one final rumor. We don't do a lot of rumor mongering, but John Presser over on his YouTube channel, and he says he's in the past had some reliable info. He thinks that the Apple Glass is what he thinks it'll be called, will be launched, announced late next year to be released in 2021. I don't care about timing. What I care about is this one bit that he says is that the inside out tracking, the cameras that go inside it will just be LiDAR only. And he thinks Apple is going to be making a pair of glasses or is designing a pair of glasses that won't use traditional computer vision for privacy reasons, but will primarily just use LiDAR for placing objects into the world. You'll need that kind of, you know, mapping, but not for necessarily recognizing objects,
which they're bringing to the iPads now too, so
exactly
kind of makes sense,
and potentially the next phone.
I will just throw this out here too, we're not talking about connectivity really, and I do think I think 5G, a fully implemented version of 5G that's low latency, that can also get you high bandwidth when you need it, that will be key to a lot of this, because the problem with standalone sets right now, you look at the Oculus Quest, it's running on mobile hardware, it's very limited in terms of what it can do. If we had persistent connectivity that we could actually rely on, that where you're not walking around and worrying about your bars or anything, then you could put on a pair of glasses and have so much of the processing done from the cloud. That could be astounding. And I think we're not quite thinking about what 5G could enable yet, because it's been a lot of Qualcomm marketing up until now. But, you know, I think back to like the days when, even before Wi-Fi was like ubiquitous, I went to college from like 2001 to 2005. And when I got to school, you know, it was all Ethernet. Somewhere around the midways, Wi-Fi started coming out and I got like a little router and I was able to set up my own network. And that unleashed a whole new world of freedom. Like I could go outside my room and still be online. So, and now it's hard to imagine a world without that. And it's hard to imagine a world without LTE. So the freedom of something like 5G, if it actually works out properly, could change. And that would be the key to this.
I'm totally with you. I and the problem, like, I often get hung up because I think of the 5G affecting my world in terms of games a lot.
And
I don't want internet latency in my games. Like, keep it out. I want that locally processed. But when it comes to AR and what I'm going to be scanning and, you know, perceiving and the information that I'll need as I move around, it's a lot more akin to a Maps app. And that is already streamed from the cloud. And I think that makes absolutely great sense, especially in an AR context where motion sickness really isn't going to be a problem.
And you're talking about 5G in the millimeter wave bandwidth, not the low-end 5G that we see in phones today.
I mean, the full implementation of 5G in a couple of years. You know, think about why Apple was slow to LTE. Those early LTE phones were so slow and so big and had terrible battery life. I remember walking around Brooklyn with the HTC Thunderbolt. That was one of the first ones. And then, you know, they took a while with LTE, but by the time it reached the iPhones, it was a little more solid. Like, it didn't kill battery as much. It all kind of made more sense. So I'm hoping we'll see a 5G iPhone soon, probably next year at this point. but I can see the glasses really rooting into that technology for sure.
And that's one of those things they don't control, right? Yep. Even though they control software pipeline, they control integration with their chips. They don't control the carriers. They don't control the modems as of, you know, last year when they considered buying Intel's 5G technology. And so that's all have that to kind of build up the runway to do something that they control. And the carriers are wise to the relationships with Apple now. They don't want to get shorted the way that, you know, Singular and AT&T were iPhone, right? First launch. Yeah. And so that's one of the few places where Apple has to be beholden to partners.
I just want to drive home your original point that the leaker says that there will not be a front-facing camera on these glasses. Which is kind of crazy. Like if you look at it on the face of it, but the article makes a very good point that is the only thing that people discuss surrounding Google Glass.
Right.
And it became a privacy discussion. And if Apple chooses not to do that, for that reason, that makes a whole lot of sense. And
for sure.
And I'm glad that LiDAR can compensate for that and still give us world scanning without all of the privacy concerns.
You know, that's it's a semantics question now, because their implementation of LiDAR is just an IR camera with IR blasters. You still get it's still a CMOS type sensor, right, with global shutter, that sure, the way they process information may be dots, but as that technology gets better and the dots get more refined, you know, better than what you get in the back of the iPhone now, but more like the FaceTime ones, that resolution, you can still infer faces, infer all sorts of things that, you know, on the IR spectrum that you wouldn't necessarily get with standard computer vision.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at the very least they could say, hey, we don't have cameras. Right. And maybe as you know them. And maybe the future of LiDAR would be a more efficient way of doing a lot of this too. Because cameras, they're built for different work. We are sort of, computer vision is this idea of rendering data from the images we're seeing. And it's kind of taking a backwards approach to, you know, learning from the world and seeing the world. And LiDAR would make a lot of sense. That's how so many machines have been relying on radar for quite a while. So yeah, it would make a lot more sense.
Last bit of news in the AR VR world is that Nreal, which Vinjal, you mentioned earlier, these are the kind of more sunglasses like AR glasses. They use traditional combiners, no light fields, no waveguides, but they have very compact AR glasses. Their developer kit is now available for pre-order and shipping soon. But that's going to be a $1,200 kit with a side computing processor as opposed to being plugged to a phone. Their whole thing is they want to sell eventually a $500 pair of glasses that you can plug into an Android phone running a Qualcomm chip. That's where they have a partnership, so 855 or faster, and get things like video and hand tracking and 6 degrees of freedom with the AR set. So that's something, if you're an AR developer, you might want to look into, and that's $1,200 at nreal.ai.
That's super cool. One thing, as we're talking about cameras, by the way, did you guys see that the new Sony sensor with the built-in like machine learning capabilities?
No.
So it was a weird little release, and Sony contacted me last week about it just to chat with one of their chip guys. So I wrote this up at Engadget. These are two new sensors that have an AI processing chip like on the back. So previously people would you would build a hardware around a camera for AI processing, but these will be able to do work on their own. So they will have like basic object recognition, which is kind of interesting. So Sony was saying like, yeah, a store could put a camera at the front of the store or something, and instead of spitting out the full video of what it's seeing, it can spit out the metadata of what it's seeing. So it could be like, this person would just walk in, no mask, no face mask, alert security. And then it's a good privacy thing too, because you're not sharing full video, you're just sharing metadata, but it could be used for like monitoring inventory of a shelf or something. So it could alert the stores like, hey, you're running low on toilet paper because people are pandemic prepping. That it's not like full AI. It's very simplistic at this point, but they say it can do basic object recognition. It could do like a single object. It can do tracking people. They could track heat maps within cities or something, like what is the busiest part of my store? And to me, this is just an interesting step of like, yes, the sensors themselves getting smarter This could really enable a lot of things.
Well, also tapping into databases. All sounds like it's coming out of deep learning, where they're taking, you know, recognition of objects at a near instant pace. And cameras, digital cameras, have had a version of this in their image enhancement software for a long time. So, like a lot of these point and shoots or Sony cameras will say, we'll pull from a database of, you know, a million flowers that we've shot before. And so when you take a picture of a flower, it knows how to enhance the image for a flower or for a face. And so using that type of technology, but for more, like you said, image recognition purposes, where CV, you have to do it on a per frame basis.
Yep. So the cameras themselves are getting smarter. And also yesterday, Microsoft announced they're partnering with Sony for this. So like, this is going to use some Azure tech as well. Mm. So nobody is really talking about it, but I do think this could affect the way stores and other things work in the next couple of years. Yeah.
Amazon won't be the only one in the game for those type of stores with all the cameras, the Amazon stores. We're going to get to Azure Tech in just a moment. But before we move on to our next segment, Kishore's not here, obviously, but we're hoping that we're going to have still a moment of science, a pre-recorded segment where Kishore, we're going to get our COVID-19 update, but Kishore will chat with a psychologist about some of the kind of psychological implications of the quarantine and lockdown that we're dealing in the world, and specifically the anxiety that we're all feeling. So if all goes well, let's throw to that segment right now.
Welcome to the first in a series that I'm calling Living with COVID, where I talk to a series of experts about what the new normal is going to look like and their predictions, their understanding based on history and of science of how we're going to need to adapt to those times. I'm really excited to have on our first guest, Dr. Ali Mattu. He's a psychologist. He's the host of the YouTube series, The Psych Show. And probably most importantly, he's my friend. And we're going to talk about anxiety, which is something that you've specialized in. And I want to start with something, I don't know, it feels almost weird to ask, but I have been anxious for the better part of 3 months. And I just want to ask, is that normal?
Yeah, well, I mean, none of this is normal. And now it's our normal. So it's become normal. Like, we've never, it's been many, many, many years since we as a people have experienced this kind of thing. 1918 is probably the closest parallel we have to this. But yeah, this is absolutely normal to be very stressed, because we're dealing with a lot of stressors in our daily life, whether it's the work we're now having to do at home, or trying to find work, or trying to manage our kids, all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of real fear when you go outside, because going outside now, things that were usually only common with something like a post-traumatic response, being hypervigilant, being very on guard, that is now the new normal, because there are real things to be afraid of when you're outside. And then anxiety about the future, what's going to happen, uncertainty, we don't know. Week to week, things are changing rapidly. So yeah, anxiety is it's the name of the game. I've been experiencing a lot of it too, my friend.
One of the ways that I experience anxiety now is that, you know, a couple months into this, I kind of know the basics of what's going on. I know the behaviors I need to do. I know the basics of what's happening. But I find as I read more and more about this, especially on a daily basis, like if I'm on Twitter all day consuming every bit of coronavirus information, like, it makes me more anxious. I have a harder time sleeping.
Never do that.
So is that a real thing? Like, there's like a technology hygiene and an information hygiene we have to be thoughtful of, especially as we go forward into this next phase, because we're talking about, you know, living with this for like 12 to 18 months.
So anxiety is fueled by uncertainty. When you don't know how things are going to play out, and there seems to be some kind of real danger there, or it's a new situation, or it's something that you haven't done in a long time, anxiety is normal in those situations, and uncertainty will make it worse. It will heighten it. One of the things that our mind wants to do when we're dealing with uncertainty is to get more certainty. Well, in some situations, you can do that. You can look up more information. You can talk to people. You can check in with people who might have more experience with this. But in other situations, you can't. It's like if you apply to college, you send in all your stuff, and then you have to sit with it. Like, you're not going to get any benefit from, like, reloading your email inbox and seeing if you've heard back from colleges. You just sort of have to wait and see how it plays out. So similarly here, we all want more certainty. We want to know what to do. But, and that's why we go to Twitter, or we might look up news and refresh these pages. But morning to evening, there really isn't that much change. So while we all need, like, we all need local news now more than we ever did a few months ago, and we need some national news, we don't need all of it all the time, because more news is not going to give you more certainty. It's going to change day by day. So that's something I've been talking to a lot of people about, is get a little bit of news in a way that is healthy for you in the morning and in the afternoon, and that's it. Maybe that means listening to NPR. Maybe that means watching the morning and evening news. Maybe it means just scanning the front page of the New York Times. But don't get stuck in that endless scroll, because it's not going to give you more certainty. But that's exactly what your mind is trying to get out of that situation.
So there seems to be different levels of anxiety that people are experiencing too. There's kind of like this day-to-day kind of anxiety about, you know, just taking a walk outside, going to the grocery store, some basic things that, at least to me, some repetition and some just getting used to it has helped me overcome. But then there's the long-term anxiety of, like, what's it going to look like to send my kid to school this fall? What's it going to look like? Am I going to have a job later? Like, all of, like, the big picture stuff. So there's, like, the day-to-day stuff that I imagine there's some, like, routine and habits that I can do. But how do you manage the anxiety about some of the bigger picture stuff that are, you know, that, like, will massively change the way my life works, depending on how it goes?
I think that is one of the most important skills we all need to develop right now, is managing that long-term uncertainty, the anxiety about the future, the unknown nature of the future. And whether you're talking about your kid's school, or you're thinking about your work and funding and budgets and all of these kind of things, there's models, but the models are like, well, it could be this, or we could be doing this. We might also do this, and there's also the chance of this other thing that we might do. And as most organizations and schools and governments don't know which path we're going to go down, because we just don't know what infection rates are going to look like. We don't know what guidelines there's going to be from the federal government, from your state government, from local government. Like, here, we're both here in California. There's a very big difference between reopening in one part of the state versus Southern California versus the Bay Area. Every local community is in a different spot. So massive uncertainty about the future. One way you deal with it is by doing as much as you can to focus on the present. So focusing on the challenges you have of today, of tomorrow, of the next week, and getting a little sense of what the future paths might be, but not getting too stuck in that. Because here's the thing, is all of these models we have, they all could change in a month or two, and we just don't know. So there really isn't too much benefit to be doing a lot of big long-term planning. The best we can do is really plan out for today, for the week ahead, maybe look at this next month and how you can set up yourself, your family, your loved ones, your close friends for success in navigating this next month. And that's it. And tolerate that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We've been through parts of this before. And that's why there's no good scientific answer for what happens during a public health disaster. and a financial collapse with prolonged periods of isolation and maybe complete rapid change of culture and how we interact with each other. There's no science on that. But we have gone through periods of big uncertainty in the past. We've gone through world wars. We have gone through the 1918 flu outbreak. And humanity has learned in those moments how to deal with long-term uncertainty. And it goes back to being here and being as prepared as you can for dealing with this immediate future, not worrying too much about the long-term future.
So is that really going to be the key for us over the next year, is to focus as close as we can to the present moment? Because we're going to have to live with this feeling of uncertainty for a long period of time. And I know as somebody that works in science communication, I've often given the advice of like, this is the time to develop a healthy relationship with uncertainty, because that's going to be the flavor of the moment. Are there skills that people can practice in the today that will help them 3-6 months down the line as we start to navigate this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the mega skill right there, is ending that fight with uncertainty. I've never lived in an experience such as this where I just can't make any plans for 6 months from now, for a year from now. I can't, because I just don't know. So this is such a new experience for all of us. And what I found is the ways that help me with my mental health in February are not the skills that help me in March, April, May, and now, and going into the future. So that's the first thing I have to say, is managing uncertainty means getting very good at managing your mental health right now. And so we're talking about things like sleep becomes super important, getting really good at sleep. Number two, getting really good at solving immediate problems. The thing about stress is stress can be helpful if we listen to it, understand it, make friends with it, because it's giving you important information about a challenge that you are facing in your life right now. But stress also really focuses you very narrowly on that immediate problem. And the situation that we're all dealing with is we have lots of stressors. So we don't get that great at solving problems when we have a number of different stressors. So this means we need more help. That means talking to the people in your life, learning problem-solving skills, like brainstorming a bunch of different solutions to a problem without judging them and trying one out, getting really good at solving immediate problems that we're all facing as individuals, as families. That's a big skill to get through the situation. And related to stress, we have bodies that are wired to respond to an animal chasing us that produces a stress response. And we have that same stress response that kicks into gear when you see this massive unread email inbox. And so we all need to find new ways of getting physical activity and working out some of that tension. And this has been a big challenge for me. I've had to start doing daddy's dance class with my daughter at home for us to get some of that physical activity out. And that's not something I'd ever do in the past, but it is something that's helped me with some of the physical amped stress that I've been getting. It also means being very compassionate with ourselves. With this much uncertainty and this pandemic, it's very hard to get things done. Like, being productive in this type of climate is staying alive, keeping your friends and family alive, and also getting through the minimal amount of work that you need to. So when we fight with our loved ones, when we're struggling, when we're mad at ourselves, we got to dig deep in to find compassion for being a human being in this extraordinary circumstance. Yeah.
The place I've struggled most with compassion is as we're starting to open up and we're going out into the world and there are all these strangers, I am so easily triggered and judgmental about the behaviors others are taking in the world.
Yeah.
And it makes me anxious. Like, if I see somebody not wearing a mask, I'm almost flipping out in my head. And I'm realizing, like, these are things I have no control over. And if we, totally. Like, if I was being, like, totally rational about it and zoomed out, like, the one person wearing the mask probably doesn't have, like, an uber effect on the whole of population about the spread of disease. But, like, it really gnaws at me. And I realizing, like, this period where we're going to go through and things are going to open up, we're going to all have to go through that period of, like, re-understanding what it means to socialize with people and not being completely anxious about it.
Yeah, as we're recording this, it's May of 2020, and we are about 6 months into a global pandemic. So we're really at the very beginning of this. And a year from now, 2 years from now, culture is going to change in some profound ways. But all those pieces haven't come together yet. So we're in America, we haven't had a culture of wearing masks when you are sick, or to try to prevent the chances of giving what you might have to someone else. I think in a year, 2 years from now, public messaging campaigns, cultural change, that feedback, that anger you might have to someone who's not wearing a mask, like, that kind of stuff will spread out through the culture, and we're going to be in a very different place. But we're at the very beginning of this. And so I struggle with that myself. I've been wearing a mask, and I've gone out riding my bike and wearing a mask, which is really difficult if you're doing any physical activity outside, especially now that it's getting hot. It's hard to do that while wearing a mask. And then one day last week, I went to go get something for my car, and I didn't put a mask on because I thought, okay, it's just going to be like a minute. I don't want to use a mask and then have to, like, clean it, use my cloth mask, and then have to clean it afterwards just for going to the car. And in that minute, I like crossed paths with someone who gave me this look, and I wanted to, like, scream out, no, I'm a mask person. It's just like a 1 minute thing. I didn't want to, like, waste water on cleaning this. But so this gets back to, like, the fundamental attribution error. We have very good explanations for why we might do something or not do something, and we don't for other people. We assume that they're, like, a bad person. I think fundamentally people want to move through this. They want to stay healthy. They don't want to get each other sick. But there's a number of factors that might play into why someone might wear a mask and why they might not. They might not have access to the one, or they might just not know. But that will change in time. I really believe that this is an opportunity for us to grow and put into place the infrastructure and culture and change that is going to help us better navigate the next future public health problem that we might face. Like, people have been, physicians, everyone in healthcare, public health, has been trying to get people to actually wash their hands for decades. Like, no one's ever done it.
Yeah, this could have a massive impact on a number of diseases, just like hand washing, a higher degree of hand washing. I keep hearing that from public health officials, and it's just sort of amazing. It's like the small actions can have numerous effects, and if that's what we walk away from this experience with, all the better. I love that.
Before 1918, people spit publicly. Like, that was a part of culture, and there had to be signs put up that said, do not spit, it spreads disease. And now spitting is largely gone, or at least not as socially acceptable as it used to be. We're going to see similar change now.
So I have to admit, I love this, like, tinge of optimism you just snuck in there. And I'm hungry for it. And I have those friends that have been, like, playing Pandemic and watching, like, zombie movies and stuff. And I was like, they're looking for the stories that, you know, like, tell these kinds of pessimistic tales of what happens next.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for the stories that are much more optimistic right now, because it's hard imagining what society is going to look like after all this is over. But that's, like, that's what, like, science fiction is so good at doing. Mm-hmm. And I know, as a fellow sci-fi nerd, you've probably been thinking about this. Like, are there stories out there that you really look at, or that are interesting to think about in the context of imagining what's next.
You know, the first place my head went to with this crisis is Jurassic Park, because Jurassic Park is this story of people not really listening to the scientists and the hubris. In thinking
all I can think of is hold on to your butts right now. That's a, for this explanation.
I'm thinking of that. I'm thinking of the lawyer getting eaten. I don't know what that says about me. But, you know, it's such a story of hubris, believing that we can tame and master nature. And that's sort of the first place my head goes to with this pandemic. But where I am now, the thing that's been helping me most, probably not going to be a surprise to you, is Star Trek. Is it in two ways. People often forget that the story of Star Trek begins with the end of World War III. And it's in this complete disaster state that Earth is in that it rebuilds something new. It makes first contact with this alien race, the Vulcans. And then they spend the next 100 years trying to solve poverty and disease and work together towards this peaceful exploration of space. So I did a Nerd Night talk, must be almost 10 years ago now, about can we achieve this utopian vision? And I talked about how all the research points to, if we encounter aliens, if they don't kill us, we're probably gonna kill them. Like, it's gonna be very hard to have empathy for someone who can't communicate and looks very different than us. And I also talked about how difficult it is for all of us to work together. But I ended that talk saying there are certain situations where our survival or our need to accomplish a goal, if it's a superordinate goal, if we have to work together across countries or teams or tribes, then we are able to do that if it's absolutely necessary. And I think the United States was founded on that principle. It was in the colony's interest to work together to overcome this problem. And of course, we've had challenges. The EU is the same kind of way. The EU was born out of the disaster of World War II. And the idea was, let's make ourselves economically interdependent so that we don't go to war again with each other. So for a long time, I believe the thing that would help us achieve a piece of that utopian future in Star Trek is climate change, because climate change is going to be the thing that...
It affects everyone.
It affects everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Rich countries, poor countries, small countries, large, the whole planet. The problem with climate change is it's so incremental in experiencing those problems, and of course that will change with time. This might be the thing, though, because this has happened so quickly, and it gives me so much hope that we are sheltering in place. Like, we are working together globally to tell this virus, hey, you don't move if we don't move. So we're going to stay put. We're going to shut things down. And I know there's struggles and there's conflicts here, but this might be the thing that we're seeing it right now. We're seeing this global cooperation at a scale I've never seen before, I never imagined would be possible. And if we can work together in the fallout of this to rebuild in the same way that they do in Star Trek, I think that can help us. And I think we can achieve part of that utopian future. And maybe that's what's going to help us to tackle even bigger problems. Because this is the thing about this virus is, as you see in Jurassic Park, you can't control nature. There are no borders here. The dinosaurs have left the island. They're here. They're in America. They're like all over the place now. So that gives me hope. What also gives me hope is in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, there's a beautiful story about the changelings, who are this race that can morph and change, and anyone can become a changeling. You see this exact storyline play out in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Do we take blood tests from everyone? And a pushback that actually comes from Earth and Utopia, they don't want to change the culture. And there's this discussion of how much do you sacrifice your ideals and who you are to protect the public. So if people want a story that explores that, just get through the first two seasons of Deep Space Nine that are not that exciting, and you will have that story in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, that's an incredible allegory for the moment. I have to say, that was a good platform to run for president of the Federation that you just presented. So good luck with the campaign.
Yes, please tell all the Federation Council members to vote Montu in 2423 or whatever.
I know there isn't one piece of advice or one size fits all for managing anxiety, but if it is there like one or two messages that you would say people should really think about as they're navigating this upcoming period?
We got to listen to our anxiety. It's telling us important things. Don't fight it. It's there for a reason. Listen to it, understand it, get comfortable with the discomfortable feelings that we have. So that's number one. Number two is we're probably also feeling too much of it. So we all need new ways of coping. I've struggled very much with insomnia these past few months, and I've had to entertain skills. I was talking to a psychologist about this. This is actually my next video I'm coming out with. I talked to a psychologist and I said, help, what do I do? And she said, have you tried this? Have you tried this? And one of the skills she mentioned was visualization, which I always dismissed. Like, I would teach it to my patients, but I was like, this is not for me. So I tried that out, and it's actually profoundly helped me. So we need to revisit ways of helping us soothe our bodies and consider things that we might not have tried before. And the last part of it, all of us are going to be facing new situations we've never been in before. Start small. Take one piece of that new situation we have to be in. So for example, dropping off your kids at school is going to be very different. Your kids might have to take temperature checks before even going in the classroom. You as a parent might not be allowed anywhere near the school. Start small. Don't schedule a lot of stuff that day. Make that the one thing that you're really pushing yourself on that day. And that's okay if it's very difficult for you. Just take one piece of that. Or if you're, I was just talking to someone who hadn't gone to get takeout and they really wanted takeout. They're tired of cooking food and wanted to support a small business. And so I said, can you just go there without ordering, just drive by and see what the environment is like so you have a better picture of it. So don't fight it. Learn new ways to cope with it and start small.
The number one message I walk away from listening to you and other psychologists is we're all going to need help during this time.
Yeah.
And this is the time to ask for that help and help others at the same time. Are there some quick resources people should look to? And where can they find you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, so I have a playlist of coronavirus-related videos on The Psych Show. So if you go to youtube.com/The Psych Show, that gets you to my channel. And the first thing below the fold you'll see is my coronavirus playlist, a lot of stuff there. I also want to plug the American Psychological Association. If you go to apa.org, you'll see all the COVID-19 resources that are available right over there. Mass General also has a wonderful list of resources that are available related to coping. And then we all need a good laugh right now. So I'm going to make a plug for a Facebook group called Zoom Memes for Self-Quarantines. Quarantine has sort of become an identity adopted by teenagers who are coming of age during this period. So if you just check out Zoom Memes for Self-Quarantines, you're going to have a lot of fun. You're going to laugh and probably connect with other people who are struggling with this stuff in the same way that you are.
I think that might be the most interesting recommendation we're going to get from an expert over this entire series. So it's awesome.
I'm all about the memes.
Ali Matu, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're back. We didn't get a chance to watch that segment, but boy, that sure felt reassuring.
I feel far less anxious than I did a moment ago.
That's exactly how I feel. Assuming that segment worked at all. Hopefully it was as seamless as, you know, I hoped it would be. But let's move on to our next segment. I'm looking at the time right now, and boy, we are going long already. I apologize, Vindra, if you need to be somewhere
it's
soon.
All right. But,
well, let's get through technology news. Microsoft Build, their virtual Build conference, happened this week. Devendra, I saw you wrote a bunch of stories on Engadget about it. What were the top highlights?
So many stories. I mean, it's there's a lot of little things, nothing like huge. They announced a new supercomputer that's Azure powered for OpenAI, and OpenAI will be using that to test some of their models down the line. And they've done things like they built an algorithm that would like write fake news on its own. Curious things like that. They've been testing all sorts of stuff. HoloLens 2 is being expanded to more countries, which is nice. They announced a cloud for healthcare telehealth suite, basically them trying to take advantage of the fact that, yeah, a lot of stuff is happening remotely now, and remote health is going to be a big, big topic. And one thing that I think a lot of developers will be interested in is they talked about a new platform for Windows, or at least a new way of unifying the way developers build Windows apps. So right now, there are the traditional Win32 apps, like the stuff from older versions of the OS, and then there are the universal Windows platform apps, and that's the stuff in the Microsoft Store. They have like slightly more modern designs, but they're a little more restricted. And they're basically building a new platform to kind of unite these two different interfaces and to give developers a way to like modernize their older apps very quickly. It's all kind of dry, but it basically means that maybe we'll see more good stuff in the Microsoft Store soon and more usable apps and maybe apps that work better on tablets, because I've been testing out, you know, the Surface Go and the Surface Book 3, and it kills me that there aren't any really good tablet Windows apps. You know, these things are meant to be used as tablets, and at best, they're great for browsing the web or reading like digital comics or, you know, drawing something with the Surface Pen, but there's no like iPad level great tablet app. So I'm still waiting for that. Maybe we'll get that eventually. But yeah, it's a pretty straightforward build. Nothing really huge this year, surprisingly.
I think Microsoft does a really good job with their build conferences and not trying to make them consumer focus conferences. Mm-hmm. And it really is about the things that their customers, you know, the Azure customers and their enterprise users care about, all the stuff that's in the back end and some Windows stuff. Like there's no Microsoft Neo talk, right? This is not the Surface event of the fall. And same with the HoloLens. Even though HoloLens is a product that people can buy, you know, their rollout for that has been smart in that it's not been hyped like a lot of the other AR products, that they really are focused toward usability and functionality for enterprise, where people are willing to pay thousands of dollars for AR glasses in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, and they were talking more about Fluid Framework, which is this cool new way of rendering office documents. Basically, you could take components from like a spreadsheet and turn that into a table and a Word doc somewhere. And then if you edit the information in the document, it'll also be reflected on the spreadsheet. So it's kind of synchronizing atomized bits of information. And that sounds really cool. That sounds like a good place where we could end up, you know, for collaboration down the line. If you plugged in some data from a spreadsheet and you emailed it to somebody and you changed it since the time you emailed it to that person, they will still see the updated version of that data. So they're going to be launching some previews of that for Office Online and Outlook Online. That could be really cool. That could be a new way of rethinking how documents work too. Yeah.
There's some new stuff about collaboration as well that mm-hmm. I saw something about code spaces, which is this cool new thing for developers. Like GitHub is owned by Microsoft, and they like everyone stores their code on GitHub, but it's typically just like a repository that you then pull down to your systems. But they're adding this thing where you can click a button and it opens up a developing environment right in GitHub and Visual Studio Code, like in the cloud, and it's collaborative. So you can like have other developers jump in there and code with you, and you can actually compile. So it's like for developers, it's like crazy next level stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought that was really cool. There's also something I saw about this form of screen sharing where everyone has their own mouse and they're all on the same desktop, and everyone's mouse has a little avatar above it of your face, which I thought that was like a really clever use of screen sharing. If I were ever helping somebody out, like that's actually ingenious. That I don't know why no one's ever done that before.
There are a lot of really good developer-focused things like Fluid Framework. What I just talked about is going open source. So that's going to be something people can contribute to and plug in however they want in their products. Windows 10 is going to be run. It's going to be able to run Linux GUI apps. So standard Linux apps will just run. You don't have to install an X server or anything. They've had the Linux kernel in there since last year, but they're really building on all of that support. And I think it's going really well for them. Mm-hmm.
And they've also been putting out new products. You reviewed Inventor for Engadget, the Surface earbuds and headphones. What'd you think of those?
They're really good. Yeah, that review just went up. I think the Surface headphones too, they're fine. They're a minor revision over the original. It's the same drivers, same mostly everything. The cans can kind of twist 180 degrees, so they can lay flat against your chest both ways. That's nice. They're $100 less than the last time. That was, what, 2 or 3 years ago? 2 years ago. So they're a little more competitive and they still sound good. I really like the dials for dealing with noise canceling. Because most noise canceling headsets, it's really hard to control the level of that, you know. Sony's, which I love, the WH-1000 XM3s, those are the best headphones you can get today, but really you have an option between ambient sound, no noise canceling, and noise canceling, and that's it. And Microsoft gives you levels, which is nice.
And all of that feels like it's anticipating over the head, the release of the overhead headphones from Apple, the AirPods, sure, whatever they're coming out with. And it's funny because that's just the dominant product, you know, regardless of platform. It's not macOS Windows. AirPods is what everyone is trying to catch up to, mm-hmm, in that space, because it's been such a big moneymaker for Apple. And that's why the rumors are for the next iPhone, this might be the first iPhone that doesn't come with built-in tethered headphones. So they really just want to push the AirPods.
That would be so rough, because those things are so cheap, and it's like the least you could do. It's the least you could give your customers, you know, when you're buying $1,000 headphone. But
they're brave, right? They're brave enough to make that decision.
I will say, by the way, the Surface earbuds sound really great too. They have this unique design. They look like they look like gauge earrings. So they're round and they have touch surfaces. So the left one lets you swipe tracks. The right one lets you increase volume, which is more control than you get from pretty much any other wireless earbud. You know, the only issue I noticed, and Microsoft didn't announce this initially, they're kind of using an old Bluetooth pairing method. So only the right bud pairs with your phone. The left bud shares the connectivity with the right bud. So I was testing the left bud. You know, I like to wear one earbud to walk around the house and listen to podcasts. I was using the left bud and having a lot of weird connectivity issues. And then eventually Microsoft admitted, like, oh, only one side is pairing. And that is a weird issue, because that's something that's like a 3-year-old problem for wireless earbuds.
I mean, you know, one of the benefits of AirPods is that you have 3 points of connection. You have the case and each of the buds, and that gives you extra usage time too. If you're on hour-long conference calls, right, you can just switch buds and recharge. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, technically you can do that with the Surface earbuds. It's just it's not clear, and Microsoft didn't admit it. So yeah, I talked to some of the engineers, and even a lot of the reps didn't realize that this was happening. So that's my only like quibble with it. So now I'm using the right earbud on its own. It's just, I like to switch buds sometimes. Sometimes I'm doing something on my right side where I can't really wear that. But beyond that, they sound great. They're really comfortable, especially even compared to the AirPods Pro, which those sound great, and I like the noise canceling, but you can really feel that they're in your ears because they're jammed in there. They're in earbuds. The Surface earbud thing just kind of sits inside of your, like right outside your ear canal. You barely feel it. So a lot of times I'll forget I'm even wearing it, which I think is a huge improvement over a lot of other earbuds.
Same price, $250 bucks.
No, $200.
Undercuts the AirPod Pros.
Yeah, they lowered the price that they initially announced. So in the fall, they said that, the Surface earbuds would be $250. At $200, they sound really good. It's really between these and like the Jabra 75Ts, the Elite Actives. Like, I like Jabras a lot. They sound good, and they're better for exercise. But if you just want like a nice walk around the house earbud, these Surface earbuds sound surprisingly great. They're open though, so just keeping that in mind.
And you know, without kids being able to go to schools, maybe they don't need to show off having AirPods. Maybe that kind of cool factor, the accessory factor, becomes less of a thing if you're not able to walk around. I mean, that's, again, the subtext for all this is that all these companies, Sony, Jabra, Microsoft, are releasing products at almost a handicap, because no matter how good they sound, how they're priced, they're still competing against that image that Apple projects and has cultivated, and you know, with the AirPods successfully.
Yeah, definitely.
We're going to get through tech real quick. Jeremy, you have one bit of 3D printer news.
Oh, this is just a PSA. If you own a Prusa 3D printer, drivers were released yesterday, 3.9. I can't even begin to tell you what's new in it. It's a huge laundry list. It's available on GitHub or at Prusa's page. But yeah, lots of goodies for every printer they ship.
And if you want to follow more on the stuff that's happening in Build and other tech reviews, Devinder does a great job on Engadget, you and the rest of the team. So please check that out. We'll have links to your articles in the show notes. But now let's move on to the other thing we're all interested in, it's pop culture. Rather than going deep through the news, I just want to hear what you guys are watching. Devinder, you do a slash filmcast with Dave and Jeff, and you guys watch a ton of stuff. What's been on your highlights during this lockdown period without being able to go to movie theaters?
Sure. I will say, first off, a low light is Capone, the new Josh Trank movie that is apparently very popular in iTunes and other rental services because there's nothing else that's new that's renting. But yeah, beyond that, I've been watching Midnight Gospel, which is the new Netflix show, the new series from Pendleton Ward, the Adventure Time guy. And it's a really interesting show because it's sort of like, it's a semi-podcast. It is, who is it? It's based on the main characters whose name I'm forgetting the actor, but he has a podcast. He has a very popular podcast. And he's, you know, had a lot of interviews with people. And let me see here. Is it? Yeah, I believe it's Duncan Trussell. Popular podcaster. But yeah, the show itself is like a combination of interviews, like some content from the podcast, but also separate interviews with the guests. It's fully animated. It looks amazing. And the entire concept is basically the guy is a podcaster who lives in this, he like lives just on this planet where he can jump into other universes. So he puts on a VR headset that's basically a universe simulator or something. He can go in, talk to people there. You'll have really random things happening outside of the conversations. So the first episode has Dr. Drew playing the president in a world where there's a zombie apocalypse. The actual conversation is about like the meaning of life and how they're growing and maturing as adults. But the context of what you're seeing is a zombie apocalypse. And I just think it's a lot of fun. It's really interesting and deep, and the animation's gorgeous. So I'm really digging it. Check that out.
So that's a Pendleton Ward style animation, his style of humor.
Yeah.
And also he's a big VR fan. So not surprised that VR plays a big part in that. I'll just throw out, watched through the Justin Roiland Hulu show, Solar Opposites.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Really enjoying that. It really feels like just a spinoff of Rick and Morty. Maybe
maybe a little too much of a spinoff, but yeah. Yeah.
But less offensive. So Rick and Morty really pushes the kind of storytelling and kind of like the... It's real harsh at times, and here and a little dark, I guess. Solar Opposites feels a little bit tamer,
sure.
But still, I think just as funny and plenty of high concepts. Rick and Morty season 4, second half has been released on Cartoon Network, and so I've been watching that week to week. And those are getting higher and higher concepts.
So good! Feels like it's insane week. How interesting and detailed and complex these episodes are getting.
I'm thinking about, like, you know, 20 30 years ago when The Simpsons started, and that was cutting edge animation because it pushed the boundaries of comedy, humor, and kind of smarts, right? It was a smart animated comedy, and the level of smarts that a Rick and Morty kind of offers and lets its audience kind of bask in on both a lowbrow and highbrow level.
Yeah. It's deconstructing genre. It is, doing so much interesting work there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeremy, anything you're watching lately?
Devendra, I don't watch TV, so I have nothing to add to this conversation.
There's so much good TV.
I know. But what you mentioned, the show you mentioned before called Upload, like that sounds right up my alley.
You guys would love Upload. I reviewed it for Engadget as well. It is, first of all, anything Greg Daniels does is gold. And I love this guy. And this is him taking on like a sci-fi murder mystery kind of show. It is just doing all sorts of cool stuff. And it's funny. It's kind of sexy. It's cool. It's very different. Hey, and we have a guest.
Hey, baby.
He's just going to watch and listen for the rest of the show, or all maybe not for the rest of the show. It's nap time soon.
I can tell you one thing I have been watching that isn't on television. It's on YouTube. And do you know who Questlove is?
He's
the drummer for The Roots.
Of course. Come on.
I didn't know. You never know. One topic we don't discuss on this podcast is music. And I wish that we did sometimes, but Hi, Avery. He has been doing a live stream DJ set 5 nights a week since quarantine that often lasts up to 4 hours.
Yeah, it's
absolutely mind-blowing. And if you like music, go to the Roots YouTube site, watch any of the back catalog live streams. I don't know how they're still up there, because they are. It's just a DJ set with just one song after another that's copywritten. But man, I mean, the information that he gives you and the segues that he creates, incredible. You will sit there with Shazam, and one song after another, you'll be adding music to your library in no time.
That's awesome. A TV show that we want to put on our looking forward to list, CBS All Access announced that they are doing the Star Trek Captain Pike spinoff, Strange New Worlds, The Adventures of the Original Enterprise pre-Kirk. So obviously Ensign announced Captain Pike was very well received in Star Trek Discovery season 2, their version of the Spock, number 1 as well. And this, the promise of this show is that not only is it going to be the Enterprise, but it's going to be more episodic, more traditional Star Trek, more standalone stories, and not a serialized, you know, it's going to be more Twilight Zone, hopefully, and less one big mystery over the entire series, which Discovery will still tackle. So we have a lot of Star Trek shows, including Lower Decks, coming out on CBS All Access.
So much Star Trek. Have you guys been liking Picard? Because I kind of gave up on that. It is not good.
We did it. I think we came out on the other side of it, wanting too much from the show. Then what we came with.
I just want like a narrative that makes sense. And even the first episode like kind of lost me. But Discovery is good. I hope more people get to see that. Yeah.
And season 2 ended in a place that takes it to a whole different direction. So
for sure, Discovery looks so expensive. People cannot believe what this show looks like on CBS, on All Access of all things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks as good as like a movie looks, basically. Like I've seen worse looking sci-fi movies for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And then of course there's the Mandalorian casting news. Last week we talked about Temuera Morrison coming back as Boba Fett, although now there's kind of a question mark up in the air about whether he will actually play Boba Fett. But the Timothy Oliphant seems to be cast as well. And there's a lot of speculation that he may play potentially a Boba Fett. Like he might be the one potentially wearing the Boba Fett armor. Mm-hmm. I think fans are hoping that it's not just a straight up Boba Fett being brought back from the Sarlacc pit, that they do a spin.
No,
on
it seems like that story, I believe Slash Film broke the story about who Timothy Oliphant would be playing. And I don't know the character's name, but they have like backstory, like somebody who could have taken Boba Fett's armor. And there's a whole thing with there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's part of the EU, part of, I think, one of the novelizations or comic books as a minor character that they're now fleshing out potentially.
Just put Timothy Oliphant back in the, like, give him a Western, give him a hat. That's all I want to see. I love that man.
Did you know that Boba Fett isn't a Mandalorian, that he only wears Mandalorian armor?
I did not know this. I also don't care about Boba Fett. I don't understand of this.
I didn't know that last week and I got ridiculed. So thank you. Thank you, brother.
He's a cool character. I never understood the fandom obsession with him, but hey, he's cool. He's a cool guy who died real quick. Yeah.
All right. And then one last thing in pop culture, The Blacklist is doing something interesting. This is the James Spader show on ABC, NBC. They were filming their newest season and were unable to complete filming before the lockdown. And so they're seamlessly cutting in the live action footage they've shot with essentially machinima, VO'd, rendered characters.
Does not look good. But
and it does not look
they
good.
They tried. Yeah.
It is fascinating. As a way to think about what production, video production, TV shows could look like post lockdown, whether
they
it's
look like
background
the Taiwanese,
extras.
The Taiwanese news site that like does CG animations, basically a step up from that. Maybe
could it have worked with better animation? I haven't seen it.
No, I mean the fact that it's seamless. It's not part of the plot, but it's just seamlessly cut into the story. It's so jarring. It looks like CG animatics. Huh. But for fans of the show who just want to get the story and want to see the continuation of the series, it's what they're going to get. And that just is one of those new realities. Last bit, Lego announced a new haunted house set. Super fascinating. This is 3,000 pieces. Our friend, a friend attested, Carl Merriam, who designed the part of the team who designed the Apollo no, the Saturn rocket set. He was the lead on this, and there's a fun video of him and other LEGO designers talking about this massive haunted house, which has a falling elevator. So
it's a Tower of Terror. Fan,
it's a Tower of Terror, everything but the name. That does it for this show. We're running long. We stuck as close to an hour and a half as we could. Devendra, thank you so much for joining. Anything you want to shout out that you're covering, the things that you're part of?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the midst of still reviewing Surface stuff, I'm reviewing the Surface Book 3 right now, Ed Engadget, which is kind of disappointing. So I'll go more into that. But check me out on the Engadget podcast. Yeah, that's going up every week. And yeah, I talk about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com.
Cool. And Jeremy, any projects you want to talk about or things you want to shout out?
Oh, I don't know. I took a break from, I'm making a game these days on in Game Maker, which I can't wait to talk about one day, but I took a break and I made one of these on the Glowforge, which is basically a mini pin sim. So you can sit and you play your virtual reality pinball games. The flippers are in the right spot. You couldn't, you had to like build it with actual plywood before. Now you can just laser cut it. So I'm going to release those plans in the near future. Maybe shoot a video about it.
Awesome. Hopefully have that on tested in the coming weeks. We'll have more awesome stuff on the site as well. Thank everyone out there for listening and for subscribing in this lockdown period. We do have an outro this week. This comes courtesy of user Black Powder Engine. If you want to create an outro music yourself, you can just search Tested Podcast Outro, download the SoundCloud raw file, find a funny clip from this episode or past episodes, splice it in, and we'll play it at the end of the show. Devendra, again, thank you so much. We'll put all your information in description so people can follow you on social media and follow your articles and the other shows you're a part of. But until then, we'll see everyone next time. Here's the outro. If I can get it to load.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
I got into building Legos recently. The treehouse, the lunar lander, and the space station. I built my Tron light cycles.
You bought the A-Wing! Jeremy bought the A-Wing!
I've never bought Legos like this in my life. 3,000 plus pieces. And so we're doing like a bag a night.
Cozy Lego.
That's it.
That was a good one.
That was a good
Very
one.
Very cool.
Nice.
All right, we'll see you next week. Bye.